Blog Talk Radio.
Tonight it's Barbo's Voice Dead on Trundlebed Tales. Everybody, welcome to Trundlebed Tales. This is your host, Sarah Utoff, and tonight we have a very special guest. Our very second interviewee is going to be somebody who made a big hit at Lollapalooza this summer, Barb Moy's Boysted. But before I get to her, I just want to do a quick run through here. If anybody wants to participate in the show, if you want to ask her a question or just make a comment, you can call in at 714-242-5253. That's 714-242-5253. Or toll free 1-877-633-9389. That's 1-877-633-9389. And just so you know, if you're away from your computer when the next episode airs, you can also use those same numbers just to stream it through your phone. So if you want to do that, you sure can. Now, I also wanted to make sure I told everybody about the next episode that's coming up. Episode 7 is going to be a little bit in a different direction, because besides talking about Laura specifically, I want to talk about some of the things that she knew about, sort of the social history aspects that sort of surround her life and sort of 19th century America in general. And what we're going to talk about next time is one-room schools, an introduction. So we're going to kind of talk a little bit about the history and the concept of a one-room school, what it was like to go to one, and sort of the state of one-room schools in the country today. That's going to be Wednesday, March 9th. At 10 p.m. Eastern Standard Time, 9 p.m. Central Standard Time, 8 p.m. Mountain Standard Time, and 7 p.m. Pacific Standard Time. And then the next episode we just got confirmed today is going to be Michelle Martin, who's the new head of the Laura Ingalls Wilder site in Independence, Kansas. And she's going to be coming on March 23rd. At those same range of time. So I hope that you'll enjoy tonight's episode, and that we'll see you back then. So let's bring Barb on the line. Barb, are you there?
I'm here.
Oh, good. Now, see, I'm always so pleased when technology works. Well, welcome to the show. I'm sure that everybody is going to enjoy. I've had a lot of comments about you coming on, and lots of people have been retweeting about you coming on, so I hope we have a lot of people listening today. I'm sure everyone's going to enjoy it.
Well, thanks for having me. I'm very excited to be participating in the show tonight.
Well, that's what we like to hear. I wanted to start out just, why don't you go ahead, for those of you, or those of the audience who were not at Lollapalooza, why don't you just sort of introduce yourself, what your, you know, the correct way to pronounce your name, and what your job is, and what you do for a living.
Sure. My name is Barb Mays Bousted, and I am a meteorologist with the National Weather Service Office in Omaha, Nebraska. I'm a forecaster, and I also am a climatologist here, so I do everything from forecasting the weather today all the way through looking ahead for the next year or longer. And in my spare time, I'm also a PhD student at the University of Nebraska, looking to obtain a PhD in climate assessment and impacts. And this project I did that I talked about at Lollapalooza is actually becoming a part of my PhD dissertation, which is very exciting.
Oh, it's always great. We always love to see Laura show up in a dissertation. I think I've got 10 of them now that I've collected. So that's great. And you actually, they can hear you give a broadcast, because I saw you put a link on Facebook last week during the big storm, right? So we can hear you actually give a little forecast sometimes.
Yeah, sometimes we can. When we have a big weather event coming up, we record a multimedia web briefing. Each forecast office around the country will do them. if they have weather. And if I'm on duty when we've got weather coming, I'll be recording them.
Well, I just thought that was very nifty to hear somebody I knew of the weather. So, now, before we move on to a little bit more about what you talked about at Lorapalooza, I wanted to kind of talk a little bit first about the weather in general, kind of weather safety. Because now here in the Midwest, I don't know if we actually have kind of stranger weather or if it just seems that way, but we do have kind of a wide variety. We just were in the, we almost set a record here for the high yesterday, and then today we had freezing sleet and some snow. So is the Midwest an unusually active weather place?
The Midwest is an active weather place, certainly more so than say, some of the tropical areas where their weather is a little bit quieter through the year. We have four distinct seasons, which brings us a lot of things like temperature swings and storm systems. So we get a lot of the fun stuff, everything from the winter storms, like the one that went through just yesterday and today, up all the way through tornado season in the summer, flooding when we have a lot of snow melt or when we have a lot of rain, and windstorms too. We really get quite a range.
Well, a lot of times when I talk to people who are traveling into the area or to the Lora sites or have moved into the area from the Midwest from someplace else, they kind of freak out, especially when they hear their first tornado warning. Now, we get kind of a little probably too blasé about it because they happen a lot, but, you know, somebody moving into the area kind of turns a little green around the gills the first time. And I know there have been times when people have gone to the Lora sites and have hit that kind of bad weather. One time it was raining so hard on the way to Walnut Grove. We were actually on Highway 14, but we weren't there yet. We had to pull over because we just literally couldn't see. And I know another family, not to pick on Walnut Grove, but I happen to know another family who arrived and had to bang on the door to get into the basement of the Walnut Grove Museum. So if somebody is from not in the area and there is kind of a big storm like a tornado coming through, what should they know?
You know, that's a really good question. It's especially a good question for people traveling into an area where you're not familiar with the surroundings, because a lot of times when you hear a warning, you're listening to the cities that are in the warning or the counties that's under a warning. And if you don't really know what county you're in, that doesn't really help you very much. So, you know, being aware of where you are is a really important thing to do. You know, have a map handy so you can find where the nearby towns are. If you're staying in a hotel, make sure you look up what county it is so that you know if you're near a warning, so that you know if you do need to take shelter. Now, I can tell you from personal experience that it is pretty difficult to stumble into a tornado just driving around. If it was easy, then a lot more people would storm chase. But it sure is easy to run into very heavy rain, hail, and strong winds around here, especially. You know, I think a lot of people have heard things about what to do to be safe. One thing that you mentioned is perfect. Pull over if the roads don't seem safe or if you can't see. Let the storm pass, especially if it's just rain or a bit of hail. If it is a really bad storm, they actually suggest that you turn your car to face into the wind, which is a little bit scary because you have the wind blowing right towards your face, but your windshield is the strongest window in your car, so it's got the least chance of shattering on you.
Hold on there. Technology and never knowing what's going to happen.
I can hear you
okay.
Now.
Okay, that's good. We lost you a little bit. You were talking about having the car pointed into the wind.
That's right. That's actually the last thing I was saying. Just if you point the car into the wind and happen to get some hail, for example, your windshield is the least likely of your windows to shatter on you. It's the strongest window because it's reinforced. So that's just one extra measure that can help you stay safe, you know, if you find yourself caught in a bad situation. Of course, the best thing to do is to not be caught in a bad situation, to be aware of the forecasts through the day, and if they're forecasting thunderstorms, to keep yourself inside or in safe locations.
Well, what if it isn't that bad? What if it's just an extremely hot day, like the day during Lollapalooza when we all went over to Walnut Grove, and it was just, you know, that I don't know what the temperature was. I think it said 104 when I drove through Sleepy Eye. So it was a really hot day.
Well, heat is something else you want to protect yourself from. Heat is just as hazardous as a thunderstorm, especially for people who have sensitive health conditions. And, you know, some of the things you can do to protect yourself from the heat include staying inside, stay in the air conditioning if you can. If you're going to be outside, drink plenty of water, take a lot of breaks, don't exert yourself too strongly, and especially at the heart of the day, stay out of the sun.
Okay, well, now we're all feeling all safe and secure for traveling in the big bad Midwest. Let's talk about Lollapalooza and your presentation there a little bit. When you were first reading the books, did the weather always make a big impact on you? Was that something that stood out? Because she does talk about the weather a lot in the books.
Oh, absolutely. It is something that always stuck out to me. I think I started reading the books around the same age as I started getting interested in weather, so the two kind of always went hand in hand for me. So she's very detailed in her descriptions about certain weather events, for example, the grasshopper weather in Plum Creek, the tornado that happens in these happy golden years, and, of course, the long winter. So absolutely, my curiosity was always raised about the weather events throughout her books, and especially the long winter, simply because it is such a long and drawn-out story about the weather, basically.
Well, that is very true, and is certainly makes you feel like the storm just goes on forever and ever, and it's just never going to end. So when you first heard about Lollapalooza, what made you want to present?
I thought it would be, you know, I present to weather people now and again, but I thought it would be really interesting to get some feedback from people who are not weather people first, but are, you know, fans of Lauren Goes Wilder first, to introduce some weather to them and to see, you know, kind of what people thought about it. I didn't even know if the presentation would fit into what the organizers had in mind when I first heard about Lollapalooza, but I emailed and said, you know, can I give this a shot? And everybody seemed pretty excited to hear about the weather. So I definitely think that goal got met because I got so much great feedback from people about hearing about the weather in Laura's books.
Well, that's good. Yeah, we did hear an awful lot of feedback about people who liked your presentation. In fact, they liked it so much they had you come and do the weather warning the second day. So how did you get the idea to look into whether the long winter really was the worst winter?
Well, you know, it all started last winter. For those who live in the plains, they might remember that last winter, especially in the early part of it, around, say, December and January, nasty one.
Yeah. We just missed a record here. We were like, I think we were within like 10 inches of setting the record. And at that point, we were like, come on, just finish up.
Right. If we're going to be that bad, we might as well, right?
Yeah.
Well, sometime around December, I got, you know, a little bit of cabin fever, a little bit frustrated with the weather. And I thought, you know, I'll do what I like to do. I'm going to go read a book to make myself feel better. So I read The Long Winter again. And I had always asked questions in my mind as I was reading the book, you know, okay, I doubted it happened exactly like Laura wrote it, but what did happen that winter? You know, is this grandma telling a story about how she went uphill both ways in the snowdrifts, or was it legitimately that bad of a winter? And, you know, last winter, I guess it just came together enough for me to actually start digging into the data. I'm very fortunate to have the job that I do because I have access to all kinds of weather data right at my fingertips. So I could start taking a look to see what was there. And the more I dug, the more questions I had that I wanted to get answered.
So normally what I find when I'm doing research is I start with one question, and then I have to get a little bit more specific to try and actually find an answer. How did you go about comparing winters?
Oh, absolutely. And, you know, the funny part about that is I don't have a good way yet because nobody has ever come up with a way to compare winters objectively, just to look at numbers and say, yes, this winter ranks worse than this one. So a big part of the research I'm going to be doing for my PhD is actually to come up with that kind of a ranking system to rank winters for how bad they are.
Oh, wow. That's really interesting.
You know, it's a big question, and this little project opened up a really big door there.
Well, it sounds like it.
But like you said, you know, you ask one question, which was simply, how bad was that winter? And it invites so many other questions. For example, you know, this was the late 1800s. What kind of weather data is even available back then?
So what did you find?
Well, I have found that there is some weather data there. There were routine observations being taken in some of the major cities in the region, not really close to DeSmet, but in Omaha, for example, and in Des Moines, and in Minneapolis-St. Paul. I dug a little deeper, and then I found that there were some military forts in South Dakota that were taking observations that winter.
Ooh.
So that was just a little bit more. I dug a little deeper, found some records that are so old they haven't even been converted to digital format yet. But we're going to get those converted, and that's one more set of data. And this hasn't even begun to explore things like the newspapers. You know, sometimes newspapers,
mm-hmm.
they may not record every day, but they might be recording the big snowstorms. So you still haven't looked into those yet either. So it turns out there are some data. However, it doesn't really look like there's anything in DeSmet or within about 50 miles of it. So we'll have to get close.
Okay. So it seems like for official numbers, you'll have to go farther away, but you probably will be able to find hopefully some anecdotal stuff a little closer from written reports and that sort of thing.
That's what I'm hoping.
Well, I think that you'll have some luck there. The DeSmet News was always really good on history. Arby Sherwood was just very impressive in making sure that he kept the town's history alive. So having found the information, did you find that it really was a bad weather?
It was a terrible winter. It might be one of, if not the worst on record, since white settlers came into the plains.
Wow. So Laura was right.
She was right. It was really bad. Here's a funny thing about weather data from the past. They measured temperature. They had some ways of describing the wind, but they didn't. And they measured precipitation, but they measured the melted equivalent of it. They never measured snowfall routinely.
Really? I would have thought that had been fairly obvious.
No. No, it wasn't routinely observed back then. They might have observed that it was snowing. And certainly I can look at data and say, okay, if the high temperature was 19 degrees and they measured a quarter inch of precipitation, I'm going to guess that fell as snow.
Yeah, I think so.
But it isn't precise. So that does add a little twist to exploring the data, too. But even accounting for things like that, I can look at the record and get a pretty good idea that it snowed a lot there. It snowed way more than most records seem to indicate.
Well, that's really interesting because, you know, as a rule, South Dakota tends to be fairly dry, especially compared to like Iowa. The amount of rain, you know, as you go across South Dakota drops by like 13 inches. So it must have been a really, it kind of leads some credence why they believed that story that was going out that the plow was bringing rain.
You're absolutely right. The farther west you go from, say, the Great Lakes over to the Rockies, the drier it gets. And, you know, they get a few snowstorms each year up in South Dakota, but they aren't as wet as someplace like, say, Chicago or even Des Moines. And yet they had just a tremendous amount of precipitation that winter.
Now, what's probably, well, it's a little stereotypical, but one of the most memorable scenes about talking about the weather in the long winter is when the Native American man comes in and tells them about the seven winters and the seven sets of seven winters. And I a lot of times run into people, you know, it seems like people use the long winter a lot if they are stuck for writing a story. That you see every time there's a storm, there's somebody writes down, oh, it was just like the long winter, or we lit our little candle and we felt like Laura in the long winter. And this and they try and count back these seven sets of winters. And I must admit that I try and count them back to, and I don't know that it actually holds around here. But did you look into exploring that at all?
I did. And that's really interesting. I used to do that as a kid, too. In fact, there was one year, I think I was in third grade, I actually sat down and counted it all the way out to see when my next bad winter would be. And
oh,
it didn't work
God.
Out at all. Now, what I have learned through my research is that the Indian in the story was a fictitious character. He didn't actually exist.
Mm-hmm.
But it still makes you wonder, you know, why she put that in there and if that was some kind of a folklore, for example, of the area. Now, there isn't a seven-year cycle that I know of, except what there is this swing between El Niño and La Niña.
Hmm.
I don't know if maybe that was enough of a signal that people were picking up on, you know, some years are wetter and some years are drier. But that certainly could have contributed to it.
So that's approximately 7 years when it switches between the two?
It's well, it's actually a little faster than that. It's every couple of years or so we tend to swing from one to the other.
Okay.
For example, last year we were in an El Niño, and this year we're in a La Niña, and that was a pretty fast swing. Sometimes it can take up to, say, 5 or 6 years to swing between the phases.
Oh, well, that does sound pretty close. They might just have figured that out, and you're right. That would make sense that it was maybe some kind of folklore. So now that you've started, and this is going to actually be part of your thesis, what ideas are you going to try and pursue to expand it? Do you have any hot leads, or is there something else you're going to bring into it?
Oh, I have all kinds of ideas. The question is how much time I have, really. I am going to pursue the scientific angle of determining a way to rank the winters, and that's going to be a big part of the science of what I do. I'm also going to do a really in-depth analysis of that winter of 1880 to 81, not just in DeSmet, but really around the whole globe, because, you know, usually if it was really cold somewhere, it was warm somewhere else. So I'm curious.
Mm-hmm.
Where was it warm? What kind of patterns were around that winter? And what was the extent of the cold and nasty weather? Because it actually seems as though this was not just a local thing. This was something across a good part of the country. Everybody had it bad that winter.
Hmm.
So that's more the science-y side. But then I really want to start looking into how people adapted to really bad weather in the past, in Laura's time, compared to now. You know, I think you could say that everybody's vulnerable to bad weather. They're just vulnerable in different ways now than they used to be in the 1880s. So that's something we might explore, too.
Yeah.
And, go ahead.
No, I was just going to say, I think that's a really good idea. One thing that I always find so interesting about Laura, and I keep periodically trying to convince some museum to take this on, but I think they ought to do an exhibit that would be Laura Ingalls Wilder, mass-produced pioneer, and show kind of all the different things that they were dependent on getting from the train that were really mass-produced in the East, because that should be, you know, fairly easy to do because they were mass-produced. There were so many things. And when that train went through or stopped coming through, it was really, they were isolated in a way. I don't think that it would be really possible for us to be isolated today for a long term.
Oh, absolutely, because they really depended on just one channel of transportation, the railroad, and especially being such a new town where they hadn't laid in a lot of supplies, hadn't grown a lot of things in the area at the time, they were really dependent on that to keep running. Whereas now, well, you know, trucks might stop running for a few days, but they're going to come back, and if it got really bad, you know, they could airlift supplies in. So there's always a way these days to get supplies in. Just may not be to our level of convenience that we're used to anymore.
Mm-hmm. Now, I'm going to interrupt you just a second, Barb, because I want to go to the chat room. They have been talking in there about comparing winters, and, you know, when people talk about the weather, they always like to talk about what's happened to them. And I just posted a kind of a prompt about Have you encountered any strange weather on a Laura trip? And Rebecca Bramer says that on my first trip to Walnut Grove was during a huge flood. We were told the dugout site was closed to the public, but we went anyway. We didn't drive 1,000 miles to be turned away. We couldn't get too close to the creek. It was flooded all the way over to the parking lot area, but we saw the sign for the dugout standing high and dry, just as Laura described on the banks of Plum Creek. Now, I just thought that was... Oh, and she says it's exactly like Laura describes it in the books. That is one of my goals in life, is to get to Plum Creek when it's actually flooding. And I'll
get there this spring, probably, and I'm going to go out on a limb with my forecast and forecast a really high chance of it flooding there.
Oh, well, that would be absolutely great, because I just think it would be so cool to get pictures of the stream and flood. And this summer when I was walking along Plum Creek, I walked under the footbridge, because I always wade a long ways. If you're there to wade, you got to wade a ways. And there was stuff stuck under the bridge, so clearly the water had gotten up to the bottom of the footbridge that we go across there. So when it floods, it must seriously flood. Now, I'm going to ask you another question, but before I do, I just want to remind everybody that if they want to call in and ask a question, the number is 714-242-5253, 714-242-5253, or toll free 1-877-633-9389. 1-877-633-9389. Or if you want to ask Barb a question in the chat room, you can do that, and I will just read your question. Oh, we've got one more before I go back to you. Michelle Martin from the Independence home site logged in, and she said, recently at the Little House in the Prairie Museum in Independence, Kansas, we had drifts this winter with 2 consecutive winter storms. We were feeling like it was Laura's long, hard winter trying to manage the site and care for the on-site animals, which I imagine, if you don't know, listening audience, the Independence site is about as close to Oklahoma as you can get. So I'm sure it was a shock for them to get some snow at all, especially 2 storms in a row.
Yeah, that's very unusual for that area.
Yeah. So having confessed my big ambition in life to get back to the Plum Creek flooding, do you have a particular Laura weather event that you would love to see personally?
Well, I think I've seen enough of the winter to not need to see any more of that right now. The weather enthusiast and occasional storm chaser that I am, I think it would be fascinating for me to see a tornado near a home site, maybe one like the one Laura describes in These Happy Golden Years.
Yeah, since you bring that up, if you're a storm chaser, you've probably heard a lot of tornado stories. Are the ones that Laura describes in the book, like the door slowly floating down right from wherever it was picked up from, and the 2 boys being stripped naked, are those things that really kind of can happen around a tornado?
Those things really can happen around a tornado. And on top of that, those things that Laura described did happen with that tornado. I went back and checked into that tornado now, too.
You did?
I did.
Wow.
I'm not gonna give away too much, because I might present on this a bit at the next Laurapalooza, and I want there to be at least a little element of suspense.
Yeah.
But that is a really descriptive and accurate depiction of a real tornado.
Well, that is just fascinating. I hope you do present on that. I think there'll be a lot of interest in that topic. Now, not to get too far away from what you presented this last time, though, about the long winter, it seems like that book really has a strong pull for people. Is it one that you particularly liked in the series?
Absolutely. It was my favorite when I was growing up, and I seem to hear that a lot when people have read more than one book in the series, that The Long Winter is a lot of people's favorite. I think we've heard some literary people give some literary reasons about why that might be. But for me, I don't think it was the literary technique so much as, you know, just the descriptiveness of the winter and the admission that everything wasn't always rosy, that there were some moments of desperation with the family. And that kind of a story, I think, is emotional, and it really pulled me in.
Well, it really, I agree with you. I hear lots of people tell me The Long Winter is one of their favorite books. The other one people talk about a lot is Little House on the Prairie. But what I really like about The Long Winter, and I always hate to pick favorites because I kind of like to think of them as one big story. But what I like about The Long Winter and how it's designed is you start out and you have the butterfly right at the beginning. It's the small mm-hmm. picture. And then you go into it a little bit, and suddenly there's a single snowflake. And then there's bunches of snowflakes. And then the snowflakes are actually partially off the page, like they're coming out at you. And then when it all gets done at the end, there's another butterfly. And it's just such a beautifully designed book. Helen Gentry did such a wonderful job working with the Garth Williams illustrations. It just is a phenomenal experience to read it. I think it really does pull you in, and that combined with Laura's descriptions, I think we all kind of have to remind ourselves we didn't go through The Long Winter ourselves.
No. No, I think you're right. It's a very well-written book, but on top of that, the illustrations really add to the story and peeking in the heart of that horrible winter for them.
So to kind of turn on to another angle for a little bit, because it was such, I think, well-received program at Laura Palooza, and I think that inspired you a little bit to start your own blog.
So, it did. I started a blog. It is www.bousteadhill.net/wilderweather, and I think we can have links of that posted somewhere.
Yeah.
It's the Wilder Weather site, and I did start it so that I can throw tidbits there when I update my research, or when I'm going to be presenting somewhere, or when the mood strikes me and I'm observing the weather and thinking of Laura, just anything that comes to mind. I thought it would be kind of cool to have. It'll probably focus a lot on The Long Winter with me focusing on that project, but probably not just that either. It could be anything from, you know, tornado observations when I'm chasing to, I don't know, who knows. I'm pretty excited to have started it, though, because I think having one place where people can go to see this weather information will be pretty nifty.
I think it will be, too. I was very glad to see that you started that, and I think that people will be interested in that, just sort of the hard science of Laura. Any more... One of the things that I'm always looking at is how Laura is used in the classroom through the years, and kind of trying to track that and see what different people do over time. And we're kind of in a little bit of a downward slope, mostly because of the No Child Left Behind, and the requirements for that really cut down on social studies, which is where Laura was often used. But with your angle, you could maybe help tie people into using the books for science, which I think would be a really great thing, and something that a lot of people who do an in-depth unit or do homeschooling are already doing. So are we going to see more of that in terms of the weather and Laura and science on the blog as it comes on?
Absolutely. I just recently posted, actually soliciting a little bit of help from teachers who might be out there, because I do want to develop curriculum ideas for different grade levels that can connect all of the different subjects that exist in the Laura Ingalls Wilder books. You know, I think teachers are pretty aware that you can teach English and you can teach history through those books, but there's so much more to it. You can teach weather, and you can teach climate. You can teach how people interact with their environment, and you can even go so far as to teach a little math from these books. And connecting all of that together is, I think, one of the great strengths of the Laura books. And one of the outcomes of my dissertation project will be to have this curriculum come out. And I'd like to be getting on that sooner rather than later.
Well, I think that is marvelous, because I don't think there can be too much help for getting teachers to encourage them to use the books, because so many people learn from the books or learn about the books either in school when their teachers are using them in the classroom, or when a librarian, she coughs modestly, when a librarian gives them the books to read as a kid. So I'm really excited to see that you're going to go in that direction too, because I think it is really all for the good to really get into the science of the Laura books.
Absolutely. You know, for homeschooling parents, parents who have some flexibility with their curriculum, or even, you know, a parent who's got a child who's bored during the summer and they want to give them something to do, you know, the parents are teachers too in a lot of cases. And here I'll give a shout out. My mom is a Head Start teacher, and she is helps me sort of talk through connecting the different curriculum areas to the Laura Ingalls Wilder books so that they can be a part of the No Child Left Behind learning. And my mom is the one who also got me reading the Laura books too.
Well, that's good. We always want to give a shout out to moms.
Absolutely.
Actually, my mom pointed out that the your last email with the corrected number came through, so we would have been in trouble tonight if it hadn't been for my mom. So, moms are great. It's always good to have them watching your back. So, now after I got so excited about that.
I'm sorry, I didn't mean to distract you.
No, that's right.
But yeah, curriculum is what we were on. And creating this curriculum will be a really big component of what I'm doing. I have a few ideas that I want to pursue with this research once I get all that science stuff knocked out. And another one of those is writing a book on the subject of the long winter and what really happened.
Oh, really? I think that will just be very popular, because there have been a couple of books that have come out lately. The Children's Blizzard, probably the most successful one. I think that's really shown there's a market for that.
Oh, absolutely. David Lafkin put together a great story with the Children's Blizzard, and I had the privilege of meeting him. He actually came to do a book signing for American Meteorological Society a few years ago, and he is a huge Laura Ingalls Wilder fan. And he mentioned to me that when he first started out to write a book about, you know, something about blizzards, he considered whether to write the Children's Blizzard or whether to write about the Long Winter. Now, I'm pretty glad he chose the Children's Blizzard, because he did a bang-up job, and because I now get the opportunity to work out this Long Winter one.
Well, I sure hope that we'll see more of that sooner rather than later, because I'm sure it's just going to be a fascinating book, because I'll tell you, so many people have come up to me, I'll give another shout out to my mom since I mentioned her either. She was like, oh, I remember you telling me about her at Laura Palooza. I'm so glad you decided to interview her. So I think there'll be a lot of interest in the book, and I hope that we get that going. Now, as far as the curriculum, that was what I was going to say. Let's make sure there's a nice, clear shout-out. So if anybody is doing Laura in the classroom and has something involving science, weather in particular, or science in general, or just generally wants to give some good advice about using Laura's curriculum, you can contact Barb. Is there contact on your blog? I'm not entirely sure. I don't remember off the top of my head.
Yes, you can send me a message from my blog.
Okay. So go to her blog, and you want to give the address again so we get everybody going?
Sure. It is www.bousteadhill.net/wilder_weather.
And it is, if any of you go to the Trundlebed Tales blog, it's in my blog role under Wilder Weather, so you can also link to it from that. So that is all sorts of exciting things that are going to pop up in the near future. But there's, speaking of things popping up in the near future, you just got interviewed for the Homesteader too, right?
I did, for the special Laura Palooza edition.
So you're going to be coming out in the next issue, I believe. So if anybody wants to know more about Barb after we get done here tonight, which I'm sure they will, they can go ahead and get the latest issue of the Homesteader, which is, if you are unaware, the site independent newsletter that has stories about Laura from all over the country. And you can find more information about getting that at beyondthelittlehouse.com, which coincidentally is the same website of the group that puts on Laura Palooza. See how nicely that works?
Oh, and you know, even more coincidentally, the blog is linked from there, too.
Oh, see, it just all works out so well. Sandra is in the chat room, and she says that the Homesteader issue will be the winter 2010-2011 issue, and it should be out in a couple of weeks.
Yay.
And we also have a question here from Michelle Martin. She says, Barb, is it possible that Laura also drew from the Children's Blizzard of 1888 in the Northern Plains when she wrote her descriptions of the Long Winter? It's in the same region, and Laura said herself she was a writer of historical fiction. So I think she's asking, did she maybe collapse stories into one big winter?
I don't doubt that Laura's recollections of a bad winter involve just a little bit of pieces of a lot of bad winters. One of the things I found in Laura's book is that she did do a bit of literary technique from time to time where she compressed timelines, for example. It wasn't always 3 days of blizzard with only one day in between. But the experiences that people had during the children's blizzard actually were very different from the experiences of the long winter. So I don't know how much she did borrow from that particular winter. The children's blizzard happened in a winter that otherwise wasn't too bad, and it caught a lot of people unaware, which is partly what killed so many people. But during the long winter, it was so bad beginning to end that people really didn't go anywhere unless they absolutely had to, so there weren't as many people caught in the open. Surprisingly few people actually died in the series of the long winter.
Well, that is an important difference. I could really see that. And if any of you have not read The Children's Blizzard yet, which I think probably most Laura fans have, and you, I know you can get it from several of the home sites or your local library, and part of the reason why it was so bad was when the storm hit, it hit a lot of places right about the time that school was going to be getting out. So not realizing how bad a storm it was going to be, they sent the kids home on their own, and that was about the worst thing they could have done. But you can't tell that, you know, when you're stuck by yourself on the prairie. It's really kind of a fascinating idea how isolated you were, because we get so used to having this constant connection that I'll just give you a dumb little story about me, since I was watching an episode of Dallas, which I am old enough to have watched when it was on in the first place. And there is an episode where Bobby is kidnapped and they can't find him. And I, honest to God, found myself thinking, why didn't they call his cell? Which they did not have cell phones back then. So no. It's really easy to forget just how sudden and complete a change of always being in connection is. So, and that's something that really makes a difference, especially with the weather, which, to touch back on the safety thing, is something you want to make sure you are, and not listening to your iPods recordings of your favorite Trundlebed Tales episode. If there's a storm coming, you want to be listening to the real radio and the local radio that actually is telling you what's going on.
Or heck, even listen to your favorite iPod broadcast and be checking on the internet as well.
Yes, if you've got wireless going. Yeah.
Although I will, I'll put a little safety shout out now too. If you don't have one already, I strongly recommend that people have a NOAA weather radio in their homes. And if you do a lot of traveling, I also recommend you have one that's portable that you can take in your car. Because a NOAA weather radio is like a smoke detector for severe weather. It's going to go off and wake you up in the middle of the night, even if you didn't wake up and turn it on. Now, there's a lot of information you can get from a TV, but it won't turn itself on when there's bad weather. You have to actually go do that yourself and have it on the right channels. But a weather radio is always tuned to, once you program it, it's tuned to your nearest weather station, and it's going to give you a constant broadcast of weather information. But it will also kick itself on when there's a warning in your area, severe thunderstorm warning, tornado, flash flood, or winter storm warnings. And if you have one of those in your house, then it's really tough to get caught off guard.
Well, I will tell you that it is, we got one just, well, I think fairly soon after they came out, because my grandmother was a big safety net. I mean, that's why our house is on top of the hill. She wasn't going to get caught in a flood. And so we have our NOAA radio just actually in the next room, and it definitely wakes you up in the middle of the night if it goes off. And okay, we do have another couple questions in the chat room. Sandra wants to know, have you realized or figured out yet how many people did die during the long winter?
Oh, I haven't, and I don't know that I'll ever be able to create a true history of that, but I would love to be stumbling across that documentation. Of course, the question becomes, where do you stop? You know, the winter was so bad everywhere. There could be a lot of deaths around the country that were attributed to bad weather. So it's a really interesting question. And here's a little interesting bit of weather information, too. We do a really good job of documenting when people die due to floods, hurricanes, and tornadoes. We don't do a very good job of documenting when they die due to cold, unless it was a real direct, you know, somebody was left outside and died of exposure. So it's kind of tough to document those. If somebody dies in a car accident these days, are they dead because of the weather or because of the car accident? So even if we could document it, it's hard to put it in context. But that said, it is something that I'm hoping to stumble across some better documentation of, so that I can at least maybe make comparisons to 1888, if nothing else.
Oh, and the Laura Ingalls Wilder Museum in Walnut Grove chimes in that they do have a weather radio at the museum. Let's see, and I'm going to skip that sentence and just say that the Walnut Grove sirens did go off, and they got people into the basement of Grandma's house. So, yes, I think they have been the port in the storm of people many times. And I know that the Ingalls Homestead in DeSmet, that was one thing I was a little worried about, because I tend to be a little over-anxious about liability, because we were involved in a lawsuit over an incident at my 7th birthday party, and I never quite got over it. So I see liability where other people don't. And I was a little concerned when we stayed at the home because there wasn't any place to go. But they now have an official tornado shelter there, too, a nice big one. So
That warms my heart to hear that.
Yep. So.
It's one thing I'd like to help the home sites with. If they are looking for help and if they're willing, I'd like to help them build information about weather safety in their area and weather history. For example, what the weather was like during Laura's time at those different sites. So I'll likely be contacting museum sites if I haven't already. And if you feel like preempting and contacting me and you're listening, then please go right ahead and send me a message. I'd love to get in touch.
Well, I think that would be wonderful, because it is, I think, an interesting area and one that really hasn't been explored yet as far as some of the other things have been. Now, turning away from the weather a little bit, I did want to just sort of chat with you a little bit. It's a little preemptive marketing here. This was the first Laurapalooza. Would you recommend it to other people?
In a heartbeat, absolutely. I had such a blast there, and I went completely alone. I didn't know anybody else who was going. I had no idea what kind of people would be going, and I had no idea what it would be like. But I went, and I talked, and I met so many fantastic people, very friendly, very passionate about the subject, and passionate about a lot of other subjects, too. And it really brought an interesting mix of people together. So there are a lot of different subjects covered with the talks, but even beyond the talks, there's just so much neat stuff that happened that I absolutely recommend it.
Well, that is what we like to hear. It isn't scary at all. So if anybody out there is considering coming forth with a topic or a new idea or something that they may want to present with when the call for papers go out, you'd think they should just dive in, even if they don't know anybody, right?
Oh, absolutely. It's a friendly group of people, and I felt very welcomed.
Well, that's what we want to Thank you for doing our little commercial. but I didn't tell her that we were going to do that ahead of time, people. So just, well, since we're still on that, do you? What was your favorite part of Lollapalooza?
Oh, wow, that's tough. There's so many great things. I really enjoyed getting a feel for all the different people who are interested in the Laura books, the real range of people who came there, who ranged from scholars to teachers to fans to children. It was such an eclectic mix of people, and I didn't really expect that, I think. So getting to know the people who were interested in the subject may have been my favorite part, but I also really enjoyed a lot of the talks, and I really enjoyed meeting a lot of the authors of biographies and other books that I had been reading, and I really enjoyed the after hours entertainment as well.
Well, great. Thank you. We actually have somebody calling in to ask us a question. So this is big excitement. So area code 620, I am going to go ahead and put you on with me and Barbara. So I hope.
Hi.
There we go. That sounds like Sandra. Is that Sandra?
It is Sandra. This is Sandra Hume. Hi, Barb.
Hi, Sandra.
How are you?
I'm good. How are you?
Great. You're sounding wonderful. I have a question that I've sort of always wondered about ever since I was a kid, and it's sort of grown since I've gotten older. I grew up in Boston, and I really wished when I was a kid that we would have blizzards just like that. And that never happened. And then unexpectedly, as an adult, I moved to Kansas to the plains, and I sort of thought that I would see it. And I haven't. And it just seems, the more I talk to people, it seems like blizzards are almost a thing of the past. And has there been a seismic shift over the last century or so away from this kind of really severe, severe weather?
You know, Sandra, that is a really interesting question. There are some hints that with climate change that we are seeing a shift in who gets what kind of weather during the winter, and that ranges from blizzards maybe not being so likely in southern parts like you are. I consider you south because you're south mm-hmm. of me, to maybe an increased amount of snow in some places that used to get missed by the storm track. And not to confuse people, but with the results of climate change, some areas could get a lot more snow because they're getting a lot more moisture than they used to. Warmer air holds more moisture. So it is actually another part of, and it's funny, you could have planted this question almost. This is another part of what I want to explore with looking into these winters. Once I create a ranking system of some kind where I can put these winters into context, I really want to dig in and see if we can actually pick out in the numbers a signal of climate change. Are we seeing more blizzards or fewer in some places? Are we getting more snow or less? Certainly I can say without hesitation the temperatures have gone up. So there is some real interesting information there to explore, absolutely.
Do we still see anywhere in this country multi-day blizzards like they describe in the long winter?
Oh, sure. We saw them here last year. They saw them up north as well. They do still happen. I don't know if they're happening with any more or less frequency than they used to, though.
Uh-huh.
That'll be another
uh-huh.
question to explore.
Okay, thanks.
Thank you.
Okay, Sandra, do you want to in person give the plug for the issue with Barb's interview?
Oh, yes. We have a little bit of almost a weather issue coming up. And of the homesteader, it's a little bit late because I put together the special Lollapalooza issue beforehand. But we've got a pretty long interview with Barb, and then we've got we're talking about also how Walnut Grove handles their weather situations, which was prompted by last summer's experience with those of us who went to Lollapalooza and then went on to Walnut Grove, where a lot of us sat in the parking lot in our cars, having been directed by personnel at the museum, well, not at the museum, but the people that were running the pageant in the town, to stay there because they knew that the storm was going to just keep going. And it was the most amazing storm to watch, but they were right. It cleared up, and we went and we watched the pageant.
That was very brave of you. I wimped out and stayed back at Shirley's, but it was a really incredible storm. So that should be really interesting, and that's going to be coming out in a couple weeks, and they can get it on Beyond Little House.
Yeah, and it got me starting to think, you know, when you have somewhere like Walnut Grove, or Dismet to a lesser degree, but Walnut Grove is really all about the pageant, and they don't have any lodging. So when they have their major, major event, all depending on the weather, it really, really makes it very important for them to know exactly what's going on. So hopefully I'll shed a little bit of light on that, too.
Well, that
sounds great to read all of it.
Yeah. Okay. Well, did you need anything else, Sandra, or should I put you back on hold?
You can put me back on hold. Thanks.
Okay. Thank you for calling in. Okay, now there's a couple of question prompts in the chat room. I have Stormbringer 7 saying that one of your weather service compatriots wants to know, how will you factor in technological advancement to gauge the severity of winters?
Oh, that is absolutely true. It is a tricky thing because we definitely don't measure weather things like we used to. The way our thermometers work have changed. The way we measure precipitation has changed from time to time. So it is a little bit tricky to get that whole record in there and compare what happened before with different instruments to what's happened now. Now, there is our National Climatic Data Center that is used to looking at that data and accounting for those changes and straightening it all out. And I'll probably lean pretty heavily on them to help me straighten it out. But part of it, I think, will be that some numbers will just be hard to nail down, and I'll have to be careful about being too precise about the numbers because we aren't as precise in the 1880s as we are now.
And we've got, I don't know if we're going to have a lot of time to answer this, but we also had Beth Scarlett in the chat room ask, was there anything historical related to Grace Ingalls Dow destroyed when the tornado hit Manchester a few years ago? Do you know anything about that? That's the big tornado. It made the cover of National Geographic. It was in the Nova episode, Search for the Super Twister, and it pretty much wiped out what was left of the town of Manchester, South Dakota.
It did wipe out what was left of Manchester. If you go there now, there is nothing but a memorial there. I don't know directly if anything related to Grace Ingalls Dow was destroyed or not, or for that matter, Harvey Dunn with his artwork, although I'm curious about that. I'd like to go back and trace where her home site was compared to where the tornado went through. But that was a very devastating tornado.
It really was probably a perfect thing for your blog and to explore a little bit more, because I always try and tell people to study that too. And it's interesting because there was actually an event in Dismet the week before that tornado. And I wanted to go out to Manchester and get some more pictures, but I was traveling with somebody else and they were ready to turn around and head back. So I said, well, that's okay. It's been there 100 years. It'll still be there next time I come. And the next week there was a tornado.
Oh, no. I also would like to know the homestead that Laura spent a summer on out in Manchester area. I'd like to know where that was relative to the tornado, too.
Okay. No, I think that's still, Sandra, did you, you can't answer me unless I put you on. I'm going to put you back on because we still have a hand up. Did you have something else to say, Sandra, or is that still showing up from the last time?
It's still showing up from the last
okay.
time.
Okay. All right. All right. Thank you. All right. Well, we are coming down to about the end of the hour. I think this seems to have gone pretty fast. How about you, Barb?
This flew by for me. I still have so much more I could talk about.
Well, I guess maybe we'll have you come back on sometime, and we'll all be sure to read your blog, which is Wilder Weather, why don't you go ahead and give it the address one more time?
www.bowsteadhill.net/wilder_weather.
And it's also linked to on my blog, which is trundlebedtales.wordpress.com. under wilder weather. So either way, we'll have to, everybody will have to tune in for that, and we will be looking with much anticipation to find out if we get to learn about that famous tornado in at the next Laurapalooza, and hopefully you'll be able to tell us at that point a little bit more about your book, because we are, I think, everybody who's in the chat room right now, which looks like it may be a record number, I'm sure are going to want to buy a copy of your book. So you're under intense pressure now to actually turn out a book at some point.
Well, now I've said it out loud on air. I'm committed.
Yes. And for everybody else, I just wanted to invite you back next time on March 9th, 2011. We're going to be doing One Room Schools, an introduction, 10 p.m. Eastern Standard Time, 9 p.m. Central Standard Time, 8 p.m. Mountain Standard Time, and 7 p.m. Pacific Standard Time. And if you're out and about next time the show's on, you can also call in and just listen through the cell phone. And I think we just got cut off, but I'm going to go ahead and hit the theme music anyway. Bye, everybody.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Thank you.